Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. I am Therapist Kelly. I'm all alone in studio today. Dr. Deborah is out, so I will be taking over, steering the ship. Just want to check in because Deborah would most likely ask me how my week was, and I was on a cruise to St. Martin, Puerto Rico, and Haiti, and I had a wonderful time, and I only wanted to throw my kids overboard maybe twice, so that's pretty good for me. So it was a lovely, lovely trip and a really good week. I hope the rest of you had a good week. And then last week, since I wasn't here, Deborah interviewed author Judy Rabinar, who wrote Befriend Your Ex. So I'm going to have to re-listen to that show because I'm sure it's super fascinating and interesting. But this week, I am super excited. We have Maggie Hadley West, and she has been an internationally recognized as an activist, independent filmmaker, public speaker, and the founder of Yo Maggie Productions. Maggie focuses on developing social justice projects related to various forms of violence, which have been previously unrecognized or underexamined. In her well-known feature-length documentary, War Zone, about the public harassment of women, Maggie turns the lens of her camera on her harassers in much the same way that they turn their aggression on her. Using a combination of black and white and color images, she creates a film that is immediate, disturbing, beautiful, and historic. Maggie has appeared on numerous national and international television and radio programs, including ABC's News Magazine show, 2020, The Today Show, CBS News, The Oprah Show, Lifetime Live, Oxygen Media, BBC, NPR, and CNN. Welcome, Maggie. I'm so excited to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you, Kelly.
So, wow, I'm just so impressed with all you've done. And, you know, this, I was looking at your work, and this film in particular really stood out to me. And it's so timely, although you made it a while ago. But I'm curious at the time why you wanted to make this film.
Well, I made the film because it was the early 90s. It was like 1990, 1991, actually, when I started doing this work. And I was just angry that I was being harassed all the time. I was 30 years old, and I could see that this kind of behavior was prevalent everywhere, including in my own family. And I thought that men in particular didn't understand what the public harassment of women was all about. And so I had been thinking about it a lot. And one day I actually picked up a small Super 8 camera at a yard sale. And on a fluke, I woke up one morning, I went, oh my God, I have a weapon. I have an equalizer. Mm. And so I took that camera out on the streets and I began doing to the men what they were doing to me.
Mm. Wow. Wow. So I caught a little bit of it. I saw the trailer and it's interesting. It was really interesting when you put the spotlight back on them, it was really interesting when I watched their reaction, they were kind of taken back. And so I'm curious sort of what your thoughts were with their reaction, and did it surprise you?
Well, I had a lot of various reactions to me shooting, and some of them surprised me. And some of them didn't. The thing that most surprised me was the difference between white men and men of color. And men of color were much more willing to engage with me and talk about what was going on and talk about our differences of opinion, while white men were actually generally more aggressive and treated me as if I had outed them and they were in trouble. And the way that I sort of interpreted that was that men of color had way bigger fish to fry than some little chick with a camera.
Uh-huh.
And that the men of, you know, white men were like much more threatened by me.
Wow. That is super fascinating. Wow. And so, okay. And how long was the film? Like, how long did it take you to create the film?
Well, at first I made a short film, and that took me, you know, part of a year. And then when I finished the short, that was in 1991, that's when I realized that I had to make a feature-length film. Mm-hmm. And so that took me 7 years total. Oh, so wow. I finished the feature-length version of Warzone in 1998.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So I'm so...
Yeah, filmmaking is not for the faint of heart.
God, that's... Wow. Wow. And I imagine, I mean, if you look back to 1991, when you originally started, what do you feel, I mean, obviously everything that's happened with the Me Too movement, but do you think things have changed for better or for worse?
Well, I do think they've changed. I think they've changed definitely for the better. And I thought that for a long time, long before Me Too. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's slow going, though. Let's be clear about that, even with Me Too, because there are complications. But when I originally started doing this work, like, I couldn't believe that I was the first person that had ever brought this to the attention of the public. And I couldn't believe that it was the first film. I mean, in 1991 and 1998, it felt like it was yeah. ridiculously late. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, now, you know, people have sort of a better understanding of it, but not when they're engaging in it, because street abuse is what I have often called it. Street mm-hmm. abuse or sexual harassment in public is kind of a rite of passage in this country. Mm. And it's a way of, you know, it's a way of defining masculinity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's still very, very pervasive.
And do you notice it in certain parts of the country more?
Well, oddly enough, when I was shooting around the country, you know, I mean, this was a long time ago, you know, mm-hmm. I was shooting in 1995, 1996, but at that time I felt more threatened in San Francisco than I did in New York City, where I was living at the time.
Wow.
And I never quite figured that out. The only thing that I could attribute that to was that there were more people mm-hmm. living on the streets. And so there was more of a feeling of danger. And I ran into one particular person in San Francisco who in the film, you know, sort of goes after me. And I was very aware that had it been at night, mm-hmm. had we been in a more isolated circumstance, he probably, you know, I know he had a weapon, so he would have wow. stabbed me or shot me.
Oh, it's terrifying. Yeah, I mean, so I'm surprised. Yeah, with everything that happened, what made you continue the film, even though you feared your life?
Well, there was no, you know, there was no possibility of not finishing the film. Right. I'm a finisher.
Right, so it wasn't even a question. Yeah. Wow.
But it's also, I also felt like then and feel like now that it's incredibly important. And one of the things that I developed in the early 90s was what I called a continuum of aggression. And it began with this very nonverbal gestural behavior and became, you know, sort of verbal and complimentary and then verbal and aggressive. Mm-hmm. And then it took on physical touching and stalking and following, and then it became sexual assault and rape. And there's a very, very clear continuum of harassment to sexual assault, rape, and murder, actually, that yes. you can see.
I was going to ask you for our listeners, because I think that it would be helpful if you could kind of define, in your opinion, what harassment is, you know, and if you can define those lines a little bit.
Sure. For me, sexual harassment is any kind of behavior that is impinging on my personal space. So it could be what I was talking just a minute ago about nonverbal behavior. It can be somebody crossing that, you know, invisible boundary mm-hmm. that you know is your private space and being threatening. So it can be gestural, it can be verbal. Mm-hmm. So it can be confusing as well, because some of it seems to be indefinable, but it's actually very simple to define. You know, women know that when a man is too close to them.
Right.
Women know that when a man accidentally touches their breast or their butt or their vagina or their arm, or when they start saying things that are sexually inappropriate to them, or they start in public, you know, they will. One of the things that was the most maddening to most women in all the years that I've talked about this was when a man would say, smile for me, as if we were there, as if women are in the public arena for that man's pleasure.
Right, right.
And so it's that constant accommodating of the man's desire. And in public, men are still free to fantasize about a woman and make her aware that he is fantasizing about her, regardless of the fact that she is not agreeing to this. And we do not agree by tacitly being in public. We do not tacitly agree by being in public.
It was interesting. Before you had said you think that men harass women because of it's sort of this masculinity modality, or I don't know what word you want to use, but why else do you think that they do it?
Well, I think that I really do believe it's a rite of passage, that it's a way of defining masculinity. I know that many men, when they are growing up, they're not necessarily comfortable engaging in this kind of behavior, but they do because otherwise they'd be perceived as less masculine.
I see.
So that can mean that it's also about power.
Definitely.
It can also mean that it's about intimidation. And there's actually something that's called rape testing. And when a man will be in public and he will actually be, you know, testing the waters for a likely victim through sexual harassment. And just to be clear, you know, it is also true that women have harassed men, only it's way, 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 way less prevalent because there's always the disparity of the physicality of a, you know, men are typically stronger than women.
Right.
And men harass men as well.
Right. So I want to understand more a little bit about the relationship between harassment on the street and in other environments like work or personal situations, what your thoughts are about that.
Well, typically, you know, men are catcalling on the streets. You know, they're saying things to women that they understand let's say a professional environment that would be less appropriate, but they are able to exercise that entitlement in public. But that doesn't mean that in a professional circumstance, as we know, that men don't engage in these kinds of behaviors. It may just become a little bit more covert, or it may be, as you know, notoriously with Harvey Weinstein, it may be couched in, you know, a business deal. But it's always about power, aggression, manipulation, threatening. And one of the things that's really important to understand about sexual harassment is because women are so accustomed to being harassed from a very, very early age. You know, we're harassed in public and then we're harassed professionally and often privately, you know, in our own relationships. So, and we understand that there is a larger threat that follows that.
Can you explain more? What do you mean?
Well, I just mean that we know that typically, you know, that women are not physically as strong as men, that we know in any given circumstance, if a man is sexually harassing us, we know that there is the potential for sexual assault or rape.
That makes sense.
And that is always there.
Right.
You know, it's always an inherent part of it. It's like the you know, the tip of the storm or something.
And if this is too personal, let me know. But did you create this film because something particular happened to you, or you just saw this happening all the time and obviously it affected you too?
Well, I did, but I didn't realize it at first when I, you know, that's kind of the beauty of art is you start working on something and then you, it's tapping into your own unconscious. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that it was something that I found very bothersome. I knew that I was afraid.
Yeah.
And I knew, I started having panic attacks while I was making this film because I thought that the very act of making the film would make me more susceptible to being raped.
Oh.
But I also, when I was 21 and I was living in Louisiana, which is where I'm living again, mm-hmm. I had been on my bike one night coming back from, a little food place. And I was literally riding down a well-lit road with my mom's voice in my ear saying, ride your bike on well-lit streets mm-hmm. because women know, that we have to protect ourselves all the time.
Of course.
7 o'clock on a Sunday night, a guy pulled me over and asked me for directions to the university and then told me to get off my bike because he was going to kill me. So I ran into a serial killer, and I know he was a serial killer because when you don't do this once. You don't try to kill once. You
Absolutely.
Don't rape
sure,
once.
Sure.
These are patterns of violence.
Right.
And I was just very, very lucky, and the guy was, he was a stupid predator.
Right.
And he had stopped me at a traffic light, and a couple of cars pulled up. And I was very identifiable, and he was very identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
So he got in his car, and he, tried to drive away, and I tried to stop his car with my body.
Wow.
So that was the impetus, mm-hmm. but I didn't know it.
Right.
That was 21. I started working on Warzone when I was 30, 32.
What's so interesting is this: the same sort of thing happened to me. I didn't think much about being harassed or when it first started for me until the Harvey Weinstein whole ordeal came out. And I had a lot of post-traumatic kind of stress come out, and I didn't
mm-hmm.
even realize.
Absolutely.
And,
me too.
Right? And it was and I think a lot mm-hmm. of women felt that way. And I thought back
yes.
and I thought, okay, what was the first time for me? And for me, I was 5 years old. My mom had bought me this gray jumpsuit that zipped from the top to the bottom. And I wore it to mm-hmm. kindergarten. And I'll never forget these three little boys who were in my class said, oh, we're going to zip down your jumper dress or whatever they called it. One of them held my arms back. One of them zipped it, and one stood there and watched. And I just mm-hmm. remember the feeling for me was just this intense shame and embarrassment when my mom, I remember coming home and my mom asking me the next week, do you want to wear your jumpsuit again? And I was like, no, I don't want to wear it. And her being like, oh, why not? You loved it. And I couldn't vocalizing it. And I remember feeling just that deep shame. So I can only imagine, when things are worse and that shame that you feel is so strong. So yeah, really, really affected me.
Well, that is very akin to being raped.
Right.
That shame that
yes.
Because that's cultural shame.
Yes.
That's not your shame.
Right.
And it's what's interesting about that is that as a 5-year-old girl,
mm-hmm.
you already knew that somehow this was your fault.
Mm.
And which is really, really obscene. And that those three little boys
mm-hmm.
already knew exactly what to do.
Yes.
I mean, that is really, really scary. And I think you're really correct that there were a lot of people that have been very traumatized, a
yes.
lot of women,
yes.
by all of the stuff that's
yes.
gone on with Me Too. And it's been very disturbing and really hard to, relive a lot of events mm-hmm. and talking about them and seeing, it's so, is it still in vogue or is it not?
Right.
I mean, I've posted things about, I was sexually assaulted by a doctor in New Orleans just mm. 9 years ago. And, you try to use those moments to move things forward a little bit, but sometimes they go nowhere
right.
fast and sometimes they go somewhere.
Yes.
So there's still a long ways to go. But before I forget, Kelly, I wanted to just say that if anybody that's listening that wants to see the movie, they can go to yomaggie.com, yomaggie.com. And also, Warzone is screening in the Philadelphia Women's Film Festival, Saturday, July 21st. And then in Brooklyn, Thursday, July 26th at the Spectacle Theater in Williamsburg. And all that information will be up on my website, hopefully by tomorrow, because I am behind schedule.
Okay. Well, it's wonderful. I mean, so did you see a resurgence of this film because of everything that happened with Me Too?
Well, unfortunately, Warzone has never lost popularity. And so there are definitely peaks and valleys in terms of screening it. But, you know, this is so pervasive that Warzone has had an audience for the entire life of the film. Yes, I'm glad it's getting out there
more in this moment,
but I'm also really, really sorry that it has to get out there.
I know what you're saying. Yeah, that makes complete sense. Well, I'd love to know if you can share a little bit about the reactions of the film almost initially, kind of in the 90s and versus today and the differences.
Well, in the 90s, you know, when I was first working on it, there was a primetime battle over the story of the making of this movie. And I mean, with 2020, and there was a show called Eye to Eye with Connie Chung and Dateline. And I ended up going with Connie Chung because of the producer, because of I trusted a producer and the way that they were going to tell the story. And I was very protective of the content. And when that show was so sexist, and Connie Chung pitted herself against me, and she pitted me against the men on the street. So she was the nice girl, and she was going to say, she said things like, wow, Maggie really has no sense of humor. And the men were humorless with me. So she took a very anti-feminist, anti-woman stance. And even claimed that this was something that was only happening to me and not happening pervasively to women. And then, you know, over the course of these years, that has really changed a lot. But that was just the media.
Right.
Because the thing that was interesting about that was, like, everybody that saw this, like, dumb show read through it. And they all knew what was going on. And so I was getting, you know, constant calls and emails and, you know, regarding the film and people thanking me for making the film. And that's mostly how it went.
Oh, right. Sure. I imagine.
Now I see that men are getting a little bit more sophisticated because it used to be that men asked me in the audience, you know, what should my daughter do? And I would say, it's not about your daughter. Your daughter, just like those boys and five-year-old you, they already know it's you that has to change.
Right. Wow. And I imagine you heard a lot of personal stories too, because this can bring up, like we were talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, so I want to play devil's advocate for 1 second. And I imagine there's some people who are saying, okay, what's the big deal? You know, I walked in the street and someone tells me that I look nice. You know, what's the problem with that? I like a compliment. It makes me feel good.
Yeah, who doesn't? The problem is you're not in a relationship with that person. You're in a public space. You're going from point A to point B. That person is invading your space. That person is, you know, number five that day, number 20 that week, number 100 that month. That person is not isolated. It is a part of a gigantic male chorus that has been going on for the breadth of our lives.
Right.
That is the problem with it.
Right.
And as I said earlier, because we know even with those seemingly benign comments, there's a hook and you don't know what the hook is. You know, sometimes the guy genuinely means, you know, hey, you look beautiful, and thinks that that's okay. And sometimes it's like, where can we go from here?
Right.
And wait, now that guy is following you down the street and he's pushing you in an alley and you're really in trouble.
Right. Yeah. No, I that makes sense. So I guess I imagine there are people who are listening also who are thinking, okay, well, what can I do if somebody down the street and I'm uncomfortable? Do I ignore them? Do I talk back? Do I act like, you know, nothing happened? And I'm curious, yeah, what you would recommend.
Well, you know, that's a little bit confusing because I don't typically say, yeah, talk back.
Mm-hmm.
But there also becomes a threshold where we can only take so much and women talk back all the time.
Sure.
But we also know when we talk back that there is the potential for escalation of the situation.
Yes, yes, I was thinking that.
And what I do advocate for is reporting. And, you know, maybe that's something that we'll get lucky and it'll change. You know, I had Warzone on the academic circuit for a long time where I would talk to students and show the film. And I would often ask the audiences to, you know, how many people and how many women in the audience had been sexually harassed in public. And invariably it was, you know, 100% of the audience.
Mm.
And then I would ask, you know, how many people had ever reported it.
Mm.
And invariably, you know, right, every 10 or 20 screenings, there would be, you know, one person,
wow,
raising their hand. And so, and, you know, and also the police don't recognize the significance,
right,
of the relationship of harassment to stalking, to, you know, mm-hmm, to sexual assault, mm-hmm, to rape. And I recently reported somebody for sexually harassing me to the police here in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And I really advocate for that because it's really important, because this culture, the culture of silence needs to be broken.
Right, right.
And it's not just in the public arena of, you know, the media.
Right.
And fame and famous people and, you know, famous harassers. It's in these tiny private little moments where, you know, none of us are safe, and we need to identify the predator.
Right. Sure. We are speaking with Maggie Hadley West. She is an activist, independent filmmaker, public speaker, and the founder of Yo Maggie Productions. We're talking about her film Warzone, which can be found at yomaggie.com. And I know we've been talking about Warzone, but I'm so curious because your other films seem so different, which is wonderful. And I'm wondering, is there like a common thread throughout all of your work or just things that you're interested in?
Yeah, I don't find them different at all, actually, because when I was making Warzone, one of the things that I was seeing was how many men of color were in the public space. And so much of that was about inequity, you know, financial inequity. And I'm an advocate, I'm an activist, you know, you have to follow your heart and you have to follow your passion, because films take years and years and, yes, years to make. So you have to be able to be in there for the duration. And so I felt like player hating a love story came right out of Warzone and my relationship with the men of color, and the fact that I was listening to hip hop music all the time at that point in my life in New York. And so player hating is about poverty and racism in the housing projects of Brooklyn. But it's also, you know, it's about, just like Warzone, it's a story of one guy and one crew,
mm-hmm,
but it's the greater story of institutional racism, as Warzone is the greater story of institutional sexism.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Sick to Death is the film that I recently completed. And all three of these are feature documentaries. And player hating took me 10 years. I'm on 6 years already with Sick to Death.
Wow.
And Sick to Death is my story of the story of my health life, mm-hmm, and being up against institutional corruption, mm-hmm, medical corruption, and people, you know, not being diagnosed with thyroid disease when I should have been diagnosed when I was a child in single digits.
Wow.
But because, you know, we live in such a sexist society, mm-hmm, and a culture that is, you know, just, you know, being overrun by big business and capitalism, monopoly capitalism, you know, it's predominantly women that are symptomatic with thyroid disease, although it happens to men too.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're not being diagnosed. So, you know, I feel like I'm always going for the big ideas, right. the big thing that's directly in front of us that, mm-hmm. you know, not being talked about in the way, like Sick to Death is the first film ever done about thyroid disease and medical corruption around it.
Wow. It's funny. I imagine you as a kid, like just kind of, were you always, you know, confident and sort of, you know, kind of, you know, knew what you were going to go after, or did this take some years for you to kind of build up?
Well, I was myself, but I lived in a very sexist household. Mm. So I was very, very squashed, as a lot of women are. Mm-hmm. And so, but I sort of couldn't contain myself or my ideas. And so I always said that I leaked out nonetheless. And then, you know, and I was unsure. I mean, when I was scared to death when Warzone started to get a lot of press.
Mm.
Because, you know, I was like, oh my God, everybody's listening to me. What if I don't know what I'm talking about?
Of course, sure.
But I do know what my experience is. Mm-hmm. And that is what I make work about.
Right. And did you have any, or currently, do you have any role models or people who you felt influenced you?
That's a very difficult question, actually. Mm. You know, well, Laurie Anderson was absolutely an influence in terms of the making of mm-hmm. Warzone, because she would take still photographs of men that harassed her in much the same way of, you know, the Japanese don't want that picture taken because it would steal their soul.
Yes.
But really, truthfully, and I don't mean this in a vanity way at all, but mm-hmm. I have felt like I've had to learn how to be my own role model. I've had to figure out how to, you know, find my way. And mm-hmm. I mean, feminism, certainly,
sure.
you know, as a movement has impacted me. I'm a feminist filmmaker
mm-hmm.
and, you know, feminist leaders and, you know, and inequality and mm-hmm. social injustice and, you know, that stuff has defined me. It's always been in my DNA to
sure.
try to change those things or at least put some tiny little, you know, dialogue.
Sure.
To participate in the dialogue, really.
So I imagine
of change.
Some people probably say, oh, that means you hate men. Do you hear that often? Or
oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I heard that for years. Uh-huh. I love men. I'm related to men.
Right.
I have a father.
Mm-hmm.
I have three brothers. I've had many, many boyfriends. I'm heterosexual.
Right.
No, I like men. And in fact, Warzone is dedicated to Lorenzo. And Lorenzo is a black man. Mm-hmm. He is my best friend. Mm-hmm. He was my friend. Then he was my boyfriend. And now he is my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And has been for, you know, probably close to 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that in Warzone, that was, you know, that was one of my ways of giving men an out.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and I always loved Lorenzo madly, because the first time I ever told Lorenzo about being harassed in public by someone, and I was mm-hmm. so upset by something that had happened on the street, and it had been a black man that was harassing
mm-hmm.
me,
mm-hmm.
he immediately understood.
Really?
He totally got it, even though nobody had ever spoken to him about it.
That's incredible, because I did notice.
It is.
Because I think it's rare. And I think, you know, like, for example, my husband, when I was telling him about the Me Too movement, I felt like he could sympathize, but he couldn't totally empathize, as growing up being male and not getting, you know, the harassment that women do. So it was just sort of interesting for me to be like, oh my God, he can't, he wants to understand, you know, completely on my level. He just can't, because he didn't grow up that way. So that's really nice.
Well, he's entitled.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing.
Right.
You know, men are entitled to behave that way. And so there's been no account and balances.
Right.
So it's normal. It's not normal behavior.
Right, but it's
normal. Been normalized culturally.
Yeah. I'd love your thoughts about.
So that's why they don't understand.
Right, right. Well, I would love your thoughts about U.S. harassment versus other countries? And obviously, it probably runs the gamut, but just kind of what you have noticed, where it's much more prevalent, where it's much less prevalent. If you can speak to that, I don't know.
Oh,
yeah.
No, there's nowhere that it's not prevalent, unless I have heard that in some indigenous cultures where women are revered and there is no rape, that's the only place where there's no harassment. Because harassment, you know, is intrinsically linked to oppression.
Mm.
It's women are property.
Right.
You know, women are oppressed to varying degrees, which we still are in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this hierarchy of aggression that almost all men engage in. And, you know, one of the things that I often said on the academic circuit was, had I been born a man, I would have done this too.
Mm.
In the same way that we are a racist culture, we are a sexist culture.
Yeah.
A homophobic culture, you know? So, you know, it is the nature of the beast. The real issue to me is, once you understand, do you check yourself or do you continue on?
Right. And the other interesting thing, and I imagine some people say this, yes, but I think it's gone too far. They may say, like, well, I can't even tell a woman now I like her haircut in the workplace. And I'm curious how you would respond to that.
Well, that's like a simple strategy. That's like a simple defensive strategy, because of course that's not true.
Mm.
Because everything is based on relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And if that, you know, because this is a two-way street. You know, women have to be able to say, you know, it makes me uncomfortable when you talk about the way I look.
Right.
Or, I really like it when you talk about the way I look. Or, I'd prefer you not talk about the way I look at work.
Right.
You know, it's all of this is boundary stuff. And some of it is condoned in the workplace, and some of it is not. The thing that's been so disturbing about, you know, harassment in public is that it's a testing ground. You know, for men to do things anonymously, because there's been nobody watching,
right?
You know, and nobody paying attention,
right?
Except for those two individuals on the street.
Sure. Well, it's so interesting, because after the whole President Trump, you know, what he had said about women and grabbing them, my 5-year-old son said to me one night about, well, he must have been 4, because it was about a year ago. He said, "Mom, I'm really scared that Trump is going to grab me in the privates." And it was so interesting to me, and so upsetting, that here's, you know, my little 4-year-old who doesn't know what's going on, but he's scared of our president, you know, and he's feeling, you know, protective and, you know, violated. And it was just...
No, he's... Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that makes perfect sense, because if he is so young that he doesn't know that he is assimilating the fear of women. But that is what's happening. He's not able to make a gender distinction.
Wow.
But when I first began shooting, the very first day that I was shooting with a white gay man. And he had never, you know, been witness to the experience of women on the street. But as a gay man, he had been, you know, he had been stalked, he'd been harassed himself, and he'd completely assimilated the fear. And that is what happens when people are awake.
Right.
And paying attention.
Mm.
And so it's unfortunate. And yes, we have a predator in chief.
Right.
And one of the things that's really unfortunate about Trump is, when he was a candidate, there was an article written about a young Russian woman that he raped, theoretically raped. I can't verify that. And it was in conjunction with, I think his name is Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted pedophile. And the woman had pressed charges when she was 19. Apparently it happened when she was about 14. And then an article came out. I mean, she pressed charges again because it went away because he had money. And so she was trying to do something again.
Right.
And the media completely ignored it. Oh. And then there was, you know, right. Pussygate.
Right.
Okay. But nonetheless, they ignored it.
Mm. And that was going to be my other question, that what do you do, or what do you recommend when women, when their job is on the line, and here they are and they're like, oh my God, no, I've gotten harassed, or, but I know that if I say something, I'm not gonna be able to, you know, feed my family, or, you know, there's this conflict of, yes, I want to stand up and I want to protect myself, but I also have to keep my job. I mean, yeah, I'm curious your thoughts around that.
Well, you know, this is the thing that we always have to deal with.
Right.
You know, what is our responsibility as human beings to ourselves, to our family, to our community, mm-hmm. and to the world at large? And I believe that it's really a faith issue, and that it is imperative that we report mm-hmm. and trust that even if you lose your job, mm. well, maybe you needed to lose that job, and
right.
another job is coming along that's
right.
way better, mm-hmm. and you'll be safer.
Mm.
And I know that's what I've always done. You know, not every single moment, but I have reported many, many times in many different ways.
Mm. I was going to say, can you speak to that a little bit? Is this going to the police or going to HR, or... what are you saying?
Well, I was harassed at the School of the Visual Arts in New York City by a teacher mm. who I had no relationship with other than I was a body in his class. I didn't know him at all.
Mm.
And in that circumstance, I registered a complaint, and they inadvertently gave me this information that this particular predator had been doing it from the 50s.
Mm.
And I wrote a couple of letters to the school, and then it's sort of, I had to make the decision to either sue or get on with my life. And I made the decision to get on with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then 5 years later, after I finished graduate school, the School of Visual Arts, and I was working for the School of the Visual Arts, I lost my job because I had the audacity to write two letters of complaint about this doctor, about this teacher that had been, mm. you know, harassing women since the 50s. And so I was like, okay, fine. I've lost my job. I filed a report with the feds. And it went absolutely nowhere.
Mm.
But I did my part.
Right, right.
You know, and it was a culture of, you know, who cares?
Sure.
Basically. Mm-hmm. But I still did my part. So that's what I'm talking about.
Right. Exactly.
You know, when the doctor sexually assaulted me here, I went to the Louisiana Medical Board
mm.
and went to the hospital.
That's fantastic.
And I just feel like we have to.
Right, right. Well, it was so interesting when everything happened with the gymnasts and the medical doctor and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
Nassar.
Oh God. And that feeling of, like, you know, them saying, like, they didn't realize that it wasn't, I mean, they were uncomfortable. They didn't realize that sort of either wasn't normal, or, you know, okay, maybe I don't know. I think a lot of women, they have that feeling of discomfort, but they just sort of sit with it. And so I totally agree with you that it's like, right. Even just reporting it, making it known, making people aware, and then that sends that message that this is not okay. So exactly, it's like you're spreading the word that this is not okay, and we can't let this continue.
Right.
Right.
And at the very least, there's a paper trail.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and sometimes the paper trails add up. And as we can see with someone like Nassar,
mm-hmm.
you know, it took forever, you know, hundreds of women, you know, many, many enablers to this predator.
Mm-hmm.
And with the doctor here in Louisiana, you know, the two detectives that interviewed me said that they told me that there had been no other reports.
Mm.
in 30 years. Mm. And I thought, really?
Right.
I found that very, very unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
But systemically, you know, women are still disregarded in many, many ways. And that is actually, of course, the direct link between War Zone and Sick to Death, both of all of which are available at yomaggie.com.
Right. Well, and so we're almost out of time, a few more minutes. I have another question for you also. With the everything that's happened with the Me Too movement, do you feel like we are heading the right direction, or are you afraid, okay, the pendulum's probably going to swing back again? Like, yes, we're heading the right direction, but, you know, it might blow over and things will kind of go back to the way they were before.
Well, things still are the way they were before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have some high-profile circumstances, you know, and we have some women that know that this is happening as everyday event for, you know, women all over the country, which is what Time's Up is about. But nonetheless, we are still in the same circumstance.
Right.
Unless you are lucky enough to have been, you know, assaulted by Harvey Weinstein or Louis C.K. or, you know,
right,
somebody that's been in the media already, chances are, you know, our little cases are falling through the cracks,
mm-hmm,
still.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is important to talk about that. So if there's any way, and I don't know what it is, by the way, you know, I can't, you know, I can only do so much as one little winch. But it's important to acknowledge that day in and day out, women are being harassed in public, in private, professionally, you know, no matter what's going on. Mm-hmm. And what I think will probably happen is, you know, people will say, men will say, well, Me Too took care of that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because that's typically what happens. But it's a huge, huge cultural issue. And when women are no longer raped in this country, then there will probably be no more sexual harassment.
Mm. And for the men who are listening, who are saying, hey, you know, I want to help too. What can I do as a man? What do you say to that?
I say pay attention to your own behavior. You know, look at where your entitlement, you know, collides with sexism and with sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I developed a test years ago for the Department of Defense, actually, for a workshop I was doing there around War Zone and sexual harassment. And what I did was, it was basically like your story of when you were 5 years old,
mm-hmm,
is I just started asking questions about when people were very, very young.
Mm.
You know, do you remember the first time you ever brushed up against somebody by accident just because you liked them?
Right.
And I took people through the idea of these questions was to take people through the progression of how this becomes a problem.
Mm.
Because in many ways, it's not their fault.
Right.
It is a cultural,
mm-hmm,
it's a cultural thing in the same way, you know, that there is bias against transgender or gay people or lesbians or, mm-hmm, you know, Native Americans or, mm-hmm, Black people or Puerto Ricans, you know, whatever it is.
Sure.
You know, we have a lot of debris to clean up.
Yes. You have been such a fantastic guest. We've been speaking with Maggie Hadley-West. She is a filmmaker, an activist, public speaker, and you can find all of her work on yomaggie.com. We've been talking about her film War Zone. My final question for you is, what's next? I'm wondering if you're having something brewing over there that we should be on the lookout for.
Well, you know, once you make a movie, when you're an independent filmmaker, mm-hmm, you make the movie and then you peddle it.
Right.
So right now I'm in the process of getting Sick to Death out in the world,
mm-hmm,
and getting as many people as possible to see it. And then I'm really, really, really hoping to take a break because I've never taken a break between movies.
Uh-huh.
And breathe.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, sort of just take care of my own health for a little while. And yes. Then we'll see what happens. You know, I'm definitely not going to shut up. It's just a question of, you know, right. What is the vehicle for the next project?
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for being such a wonderful pioneer. And I really appreciate having you on today.
Thank you, Kelly. It's been great to be with you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. So next week, we're going to have Stephen Bowers. He is the author of Secrets of World's Healthiest People. You can follow us on Instagram at Two Shrinks. Facebook is the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. Our website is docandtherapist.com. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.